But this is December 20th, 1978, and Lucia Rich is interviewing Dr. Louis Levinson of Middletown, Delaware, for the Jewish Historical Society. And now you proceed with what you would like to say, Dr. Levinson.
A man has three lives, his personal, his professional, public life. Now, which area you want, or you want to join them all up?
I'm interested in all three.
You know, well.
Maybe start with your childhood?
Yeah, sure, fine.
Where were you born?
I was born in Philadelphia, April the 30th, 1896. And we lived there till I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. And then we moved to Langhorne, Pennsylvania, which is a Quaker outfit, you know, Friends. Lovely place. It was a farming area, just like this is. And we were the only Jews in Langhorne. Now maybe there are three, four families, but we were the only ones. No, I never experienced anti-Semitism until I moved here 60 years ago.
Never in Langhorne?
No, I didn't know what it was. And worked on the farms and caddied on the golf links, milked cows, you know, the usual thing. Went to school there. It was a lovely school. The teachers were friends, and they spoke with thee and thou, you know. But it was remarkable. And then we had a rabbi come from Bristol, Langhorne, Doylestown, and you learned a little gibberish. You didn't know what it meant when you were bar mitzvah, you know. So you went into old Philadelphia, a little schnapps and lechers. No knowledge of. So
that's how you were bar mitzvah?
That's right. And as far as the Hebrew education, well, I was illiterate, you know. But I was determined if I ever had a son, he would have it full. So we lived there until probably I was about 15.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, we had. My father lost his first wife, and I had three brothers and a sister of my own. One's living, the rest of them all passed on. We moved back into Philadelphia for high school, and, you know. So I went to West Philadelphia High, and then to Penn, where I graduated in 1918. And I enlisted in 1917. Well, five of us, you know, things were bad then, very bad. Five of us took the United States Bureau of Animal Industry examination, you know, for vets. Not knowing what would happen after the war. So we were called into the Army in the year 18. And they sent me out to Omaha, Nebraska to inspect meats for the Army and Navy.
But you hadn't had any experience or education yet.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of veterinarian?
Sure.
Oh, you went to veterinarian school?
Penn for 3 years.
Oh, for Penn veterinarian school?
Yes.
I thought you went to undergraduate school.
No.
Was there no need for preparation?
In those days, there were no undergraduate
school. Oh, I see.
Not even engineers, lawyers, or nothing.
You just went
from high school into
to veterinarian school.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was almost an accident that you took this exam, they were offering it, so you just took it?
Sure, that's right. So, you know, I wanted to be a hero, you know, everybody. In the First World War, nobody knew what war was. So I wrote letters to the general, you know, who I knew in those days. He was my professor of medicine. I said, for God's sake, Marshall, get me into the army. And they'd write back, you got to send letters through military channels. Who knew, you know, in the First World War? So I wrote twice. This is where I found out it takes a big man to get above his own financial interests. I was getting $1,640 a year, which then was a lot of money. They called me in the office and said, if you write again, we will put you in uniform, you will live in a tent, and you'll get $30 a month, and you'll do the same thing you're doing now. Well, that's when I found out that there was no hope, you know, of getting into the armed forces. So, and I said, $360 a month, and I wear a uniform, or $1,640. So you know what I did. I found out that, so I was there, I was mustered out, the war was over in November. And I was mustered out in February. And they said, we need you, won't you please stay on a little while longer? So I stayed on until April, you know. And then I said, I'm going home. Well, I was home 2 weeks. You know, you get injured. I heard in this area was nice farm land, you know.
You mean Middletown area?
Middletown. Came down, looked around the farmland, cows and horses and pigs and chickens. And so I opened up here. And next April, I'll be here 60 years.
That's great. May we backtrack a moment?
Yeah.
Could you, do you remember at where your parents came from? Okay. Were they born in this country or in Europe?
My father was born on the German-Polish area. Sometimes it was Germany, sometimes Poland. Mother in Russia. And my father, he had three brothers. They had like horses, trucks that they hauled things, you know. They went to the city, you know, and bought things and brought it back. And so he loved horses. And he used to say, I've never seen a horse as big as we used to have. Well, I don't know that. Mother had something like a pub, you know, where they, in Russia, where they had tea, you know, and things like that. And the thing that I remember, she used to say, we would save the spent filies that were spent, you know, used up, and people would come in and buy cents worth of them. They were so poor. She said, we have to charge a cent, you know, they're all rushing for nothing, you know. So that those were the things that I remember. Then my father, there were four brothers, but three of them then came over and they started selling silver ware to hotels all over the United States, all over the world. And they would meet somewhere, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, you know. So this day they were to meet in Sweden, in Stockholm. You know, they had the samples, were heavy samples that they carried with them. And he said, I went in the restaurant, I was hungry, and I asked for a steak. And it was so good, I asked for another one. And the waitress says, I can give you a steer steak, not like what you had. If qualifies, what did I have? It was a horse stable. Over there, the horse people. That's it. I just had to go out of that restaurant. I got sick right away. The idea that I was eating horse meat, we just loved horses. So when they stopped, I don't know. I had an uncle that lived in Drew Boys, Pennsylvania. He had a livery stable. See horses again in coal mines. And he would come see us in Philadelphia, and he'd say, Louis, when you learn how to float horses, the teeth, it means file them, you can come out and see us. And he wore this horse hide coat with a hair on the outside. Now I know, he would be gasping as if he had asthma. He was wearing a whole horse's. He just struggled along. It was funny. It was funny. So that part of the family we lost track of. We had a uncle in Detroit, Michigan. So he had a furniture fair. I was there once, about a half block long. One of those huge things. And while I was there, my cousin said, were you ever up in a plane? I said, no. He said, well, we're going to go up in the plane. Well, there were four there, you know, four. It was one of the three motor planes. And we went up in it. But leaving there, we saw this man that we recognized. Lindbergh was there, calling on Henry Ford. Of course, as you know, Lindbergh and Ford were Hitlerites, you know, those things. And which I knew later on. You know, I didn't know at that time. So, let me see, we're that far.
Well,
so when we came out of school, we located.
I'm not sure if I understand exactly why it was that you chose Middletown.
Oh, I'll tell you. In order to get a commission in the Army, you had to have a state board examination. The Pennsylvania State Board was held in the fall. We came out of school in June. So someone said, you could down Delaware and they'll hear you orally. So we called them up and they said, yeah, under the circumstances, we'll hear you orally. So five of us came down there and we had this oral examination and we got $10. So we had that. Now, when I came home from, or after I was here 2 years, the dean of the school wrote me and said, I want you to come up and take the Pennsylvania State Board. Well, he had been good to me. His name was Dr. Louis Klein. He was a milk expert, wrote books on it. Well, I felt that if the dean asked me to do it. On the other hand, I had been informed that no one who didn't take the Pennsylvania State Boards right out of school ever passed it. So I was hesitant, you know. But when the dean asked me, I said, so I went up. But we had three examinations. We were to have three in the morning, three in the afternoon, three the next day, you know. So I didn't think they were so hard, but they were long. So the man who was secretary of the board, he said, hurry up, hurry up. I said, look, if you ask long questions, you get long answers. So there were five of them examining five of us. So I said to him, why don't you hear us oral? You know, I said, I'm busy at home. I could make $50 tomorrow. You know, it was a lot of money in those days. Came back, said, we're going to hear you oral. Well, from noon until about 5 o'clock, I had had all except one examination. I was 11, and I had seen, you know, my marks, one bar all over, 90, 95, 98. I thought I'd do pretty good. So I mentioned to the man who was head of it, Dr. Thompson, if you hear me this one more examination, save me a whole day, and I could make $50 tomorrow vaccinating hogs. So he heard me. So when I received my mark from the Secretary of the Board, it was 69 and an 8, something like that. Well, that was impossible. I knew, well, what I think he was miffed, that I had had all the exams in the day instead of 2 days, and instead of him running, maybe he thought I was running. So I wrote him, and I told him that there has to be some mistake, that I had seen 9 of my marks, and they were from 90 to 98, and I feel that I did as well in my written. So he sends me my 9 marks right, but the other one, he cut me down on the written that I, but still, it came to 89 and an 8. So he was knocking me 20 points. Anyway, that was an experience.
So you passed?
Oh, yeah, sure. With high marks.
Yeah.
89 even to what he said, you know.
Yeah.
So then I came back here, and this is a little incident. I had had the state agency for the sale of hog serum, which you vaccinate hog. I was making about 1,000, 1,200 a year. So a man was coming to see me who sold the serum out west, and he mentioned it to the head of the school board, this examining board, that he was coming to see me. He says, you know, that's one smart Jew boy down there. You know, it's funny. It's funny.
Are there any other Jews who live in Middletown?
Oh, yeah. There were Fogels and Sadovs and Rudniks and Bergs.
Were they living here at the time that you came here to practice veterinary medicine?
Yes.
Kind of the Shavers, were they here?
No.
No.
Came later.
Oh.
In fact, that's another story. My nephew, Milton Levinson, was in World War II. He was shot down, all that stuff. So we asked him, he would come here, he could stay. He'd been shot down, all that stuff, and he was nervous. And while he was here, we had him meet Thelma Shagrin Sunday mornings for breakfast. So finally he said one day, I'm going to marry that girl.
Oh, that's
so now we have the Shagrins and Levinsons.
Tell us about your life here as a member of the community. For example, we understand that at one time you were mayor of Middletown.
Well, I probably, as a naive person, I still am. I mean, I can't imagine anyone doing anything wrong deliberately. I'll never grow up. So, I said, well, the school uses coal, and my uncle owns a coal mine. I'll buy them coal wholesale, you know. It's sold on heat units. So right after I moved here. So I went before the school board. I explained to Uncle, oh, coal mine. Coal is sold on heat unit things, and I got a wholesale for them. And they didn't say anything. I found out that one of the school board members sold coal, who afterward became one of my worst political enemies. So that
Did you join the Republican Party? Is that how you got involved?
No. I was never political. In Langhorne, it was so Republican that one year a man sued the party. He had voted Democratic. They didn't even count look at the ballots. If there were 1,000 votes, there were 1,000 Republicans. So this man went. when I moved here, I was raised in a Republican area, but I was never active that way.
But you did get to be mayor here. Now, how did that happen?
Well, that's nonpartisan. So I got interested in it. I felt we ought to have a World War I monument here. I got a little group, you know, together to make it look as if it was a town affair, you know. One guy has to do it all. So they said, well, you raise money for it. How much shall I raise? So they said $1,000. Well, I know you have. You always underestimate. So I wrote an article to raise $2,000. I raised $1,800. So then they didn't know whether it should be a fountain for horses to drink out of, or a soldier standing, you know, with a gun, you know, in the old days. So it was suggested that the square was dull. It only had little lights, you know. A monument with a bulb like it is now. So we had it rigged up, and it cost $1,400. But here was the story. It's hard to understand that people would be so hard on when men lose their lives. There were four here. One was Negro, one Jewish, and two Gentiles. At first, they didn't want that Negro name on there at all. And the Jewish boy, he was captain. But he had been granted a major. He had made some invention on a rifle. Well, it hasn't been awarded to him yet, so he's going to be captain. You can't put his name first because he's a professional soldier and the others aren't. And I went all through that. Finally, I said, you've got to put officers, you know, first, list them in order. And you have to put this colored boy's name on there. His life, the... Well, finally they agreed if we would put the word colored after it.
And this was 1920?
20, on the order of that.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's hard to understand that now, you know. Mm-hmm. They were niggers, you know, in those days. So I always had in mind that inasmuch as these were raised letters and not cut into them, I could chisel them off. I would chisel that word colored off, you know. And I would have meetings with the ministers to do it, and I would cry. Could they say, well, later on, but it was never done. Now the stone is weathered, see. And if you chisel it off, it'll show because it'll be new stone. So I've said to myself, I'm not going to advocate it. At least it'll show that in one period of our history there, we had bigots. So if you look at it, where you see that. So then I
How long were you mayor?
12 years.
12 years?
Yeah, 6 terms. And that's another. Things were bad. And,
Was this in the 20s? Or the 30s?
No, it
the
must
30s?
Have been in the 30s.
Can you give us the dates when you were
I
there?
I can't do that. I'll have to, you know, I didn't look it up because it never impressed me anyway. So they, things were bad. So I got the little group, you know, together, women mostly, and some of the old families that were here. And I had signs made, all that kind of stuff. We won as mayor. And the important thing there is that I selected for members of council from the old families, but they would be a doctor, a lawyer, and 2 engineers, so that we had a competent council. And it was rare that we would have to go outside of our own sphere for knowledge. And I found out later on that some super salesman would roll in and with a little liquor and a little money and a little graft, you know, got things done. So we owned our own light plant, and taxes were $1.20 a hundred. And by fixing our own streets and we made money on our plant. In fact, here's an example. They were buying their fuel oil for the plant at the plant for 9 cents a gallon in those days. You could buy it at the railroad for 4.5 cents a gallon, just half run of the plant. So we had a 10,000 gallon tank, and I hunted around, I found an old tank, 12,000 gallon, with a few little pinholes in it. We bought it for $100, so we hauled it here and we blew air in it and soldered the little holes. So we would always have 10,000 gallon on hand, we'd order it. So we ran a little pipeline from the plant, it's about 2 blocks down there, with a little engine there, and we would pump it up. So that one move cut the cost of running our plant in half. Little gold mine. Now, Delaware Power and Light always wanted it. And I knew the president very well in those days. I said, I understand you have a company owned by stockholders. But I said, you give me a price lower than what it costs us to make it. He said, we can't do that. We charge Newark, Newcastle. Well, I had one example. I said, you're asking me to go before council and say we need a hat. The same hat costs $5 in one store, $10 in the other. And, you know, I said, that's silly. So he rolled in one day. He said, our lines from St. George's, the Summit Bridge, you go in the water there. On the canal. Once in a while, a ship breaks one. How about letting us join our lines up, sort of middle town? I said, fine. I said, you know, we'd like to have a little swap. The thing that worried me was if lightning would hit our plant, we're out. I said, if you give us standby service, if we ever need it, for 15 years, we'll let you do that. He said, no, that'll cost you $4,000 a year. I said, well, I'm sorry. One day the salesman rolled in, he said, I don't know what influence you have up there, but we're going to do it. So for 15 years we had them free, you know, in our own plant. So we made it. So then we had 2 cases of polio and typhoid, and I worried. Cesspools overflowing. Each yard had 4 or 5 cesspools overflowing. So I started looking around for sewers, you know. Well, in those days, people were out of work. I looked it up. We could get sewers for $140,000, sewer the whole town, and even go up on your own land free to where you hook up. Amazing. It was $1 a foot in those days, 16 foot deep, you know. And I also found out that it took usually 5 years for sewers to actually work, because only some of them hook up, you know. Like here, if they're all hooked up at once, it'll work good. And we actually had $4,000 left over. But here's also a story with that same gang, our enemies. They didn't want us to put the sewers in. They said we didn't investigate it right. Well, there were two methods. One was PWA, Public Works Administration, where you advertised for bids and you had engineers and you drew it up, and when it was through, you had a sewer system. The other was WPA, Work Progress Administration, where they, that's a grandfather's clock that Howard gave me when I was there. That's unusual too. So under Work Progress Administration, the state gave you relief help when they had it. Well, that was a horrible method. So they call this meeting. Boy, the school auditorium is filled. They said, you haven't investigated this thoroughly. And I reached down in the files. We had a stack of letters like this. So, and I said, under one method, when we're through, we have a complete sewer system where the water that leaves it, you can drink. Under the other, we never know. We never know. So they start, we only wanted to help Doc, and they start wringing their hand and left, you know, showed them up. So we have had a sewer system for 40 years. And oh, no sewer rent, no frontage charge. In fact, one of their arguments was that, oh, we'll have a huge sewer charge. There were no sewer, no frontage charge. Went up on your own land free, and that year deliberately we dropped taxes 5 cents to show that they were wrong.
Tell us about your enemies. Who were they, and how did they organize?
Here, both sides, the Republican, Democrats, used to swap, you know. I'll give you senator this time, you give me representative, you know. And one angle on that, the governor calls me.
What was the governor's name?
Buck.
Governor
Buck.
Oh, Buck. Buck.
Buck. He lived up here. Mm-hmm. He married Coleman de Ponsonby. And he used to come here and drink Idler. They were real friends, real good friends. He said, I want you to run for representative, state rep. I said, Governor, I live in a Democratic area, St. George's 100. Even had a governor run without any opposition. See, we have one Republican representative that wins by 20 votes. And he lives over in Odessa. Corbett with a name, very wealthy and known, you know,
the
Corbett family. You know, yeah. He would win by a squeak. So he said, well, I've seen all the walls and the crap, and they're going to support you. I said, well, I can't say no to you. You know, I made an investigation, a survey, and I'm going to win by 500 votes. Unheard of, you know. I'd helped out. I'd formed the Legion here. I'd formed Boy Scouts here. You know, so, but I could see that both parties couldn't handle me, you know. I wasn't that sort. So I'm going to win by 500 votes. I go in the alley where they hand the ballots out, have man to neighbor. I don't want to mention
names. Yeah, you can mention names.
Kogel Alston. He's scratching my name off the ballot before he hands out. My Republican Party. He's scratching before they hand it out. I could have called the cops in, you know. I could have called the Committee of 39 and seen them do it. And I said, if they have decided on this, they have reasons. They've either made deals or something like that. But I don't think he can, I don't think he knows I'm going to win by 500. I don't think he can scratch 500 off. And the job paid $600 a year, you know. He did. I lost by about 20 votes. So the governor, he's mad. Pierre de Pot was mad. He was helping me. All of them were mad. So the Republican leader, who was head of it, he gets called up by the governor, and he loses his $4,000 a year job. The Shallcross, who was postmaster through Pierre de Pot, he loses his postmaster. And I said to myself afterward, maybe it was good because I'd go down there and I would do what I thought was right and I'd be hated by inside. So I just looked at it as one of those things. So,
do you think being Jewish had any effect?
Yeah. A man that lived up here, two doors from here, he said, I can't vote for a Jew as mayor, and naturally, he would vote for it. But the fact that they had to scratch my name off of 500 ballots, okay, that elected a man by name of Sherman Webb. And he went down there, he was a Democrat, he went down there and he voted so Republican in this deal that he made that the Democrats made him move his desk over from the Republican aisle. And also this, he was then elected state senator. And he was the father-in-law of Governor Tribbett. Governor Tribbett. Now, Tribbett and I are close friends. He just had a housewarming, I think. But and he named me the head of World War I, but, you know, and also he named me official head for the Caesar Rodney ride that we had, you know, official credit. I took care of the horses going up. So, but I often said that if I had exposed his father-in-law, he would never have been governor because he learned that way, you know.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask you, can you tell us about something about your son's experiences growing up in Middletown and if you felt that you had to join a synagogue in Wilmington for his education and so forth?
Right after I moved here, I got a letter from Aaron Finger to ask me if I would join the synagogue. Well, I had had no Jewish education at all. I didn't know an olive from a beige, you know. So, and I was just starting out. I borrowed $300 and 500 folks to buy a car, and I'd save $500, you know, out of my $1,600. I started out. So, then, you know, it was 25 miles away. Now it's 25 minutes, you know. So, also, I was embarrassed. I didn't know anything about it. So, after I was here, let's see, I was 38. I came here when I was 23. So I was here, that's my mental arithmetic, like 13 years. No, 15 years. And I was well received. I'm, you know, followers like me. Anyway.
No anti-Semitism.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's another thing. You said you were
well received. Well, but see, we always had that Klan here, that Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, well, tell us about that.
Oh, I will.
Well, I mean, let's sort of...
Yes, sure, that, sure. That's right. So go on first with your other part of your story.
I had met Max Kyle through charity drives. And we would, although there were only four or five Jewish families here, we always held a Jewish charity drive, and we'd raise $2,500, you know.
For the Jewish Federation.
Gentiles, yeah, you know. We used to have plays or something like that. So I met Max Kyle through that, and he had me up to the second year that Israel was formed. He had me up to the Bellevue Stratford.
In 1949?
It must have been for this reason why it's in my mind that way. Louis Marshall, who was an international Jewish lawyer, he said, we told you we only needed money last year, and then Israel would be on its feet. So I was a Jewish optimist. We need it now again. So I assumed from that it was the second year. Also, it was brought up there, they wanted someone to head Jewish drives here, and that was when Max Kyle said, if you want a man like that, why not Aaron Finger? That was the first time I ever heard of Aaron Finger. So, Bertha Kyle was going to marry Jules Kessler. And I knew Mrs. Kyle, the second Mrs. Kyle. And Rosalind, my wife before, was giving a party for Bertha and Jules. And Rose Kyle, who's a noted matchmaker, said that Rosalind asked Mayor Levinson up, and Rosalind said, this is only for young people. You know, she said, well, I want you to answer. So she called me up one Sunday, and this is funny. Usually they call me up for some social event, and I always would say, if I'm able, you know, because my work was irregular. I said, sure, I'll be glad to be there. And when I hung up, I said, boy, that's not like me. So I go up there. I'm sitting on the couch with her aunt. And her aunt said, I never kept my eyes off of Rosalind. And this is a little fun in the family. I said, the reason why I kept my eyes on Rosalind, she looked as if she was just molded into a silk velvet gown. And I was so afraid it was going to split and break that I was going to put my coat around her right away. And Rosalind insisted it wasn't that silk, but it was. Oh, well, anyway, that's how I met Rosalind. So they would call me up and ask me, and finally, here's a lovely girl, most beautiful person in the world. And she taught English in Wilmington High School. And so things were bad then. You know, I didn't have much money. And so Rosalind's favorite remark was, when I first met him, he didn't have much, but he waited till he lost it all before he asked me to marry him. So we were married. My mother died before we were to get married. So we held it off a month. It had to be, we were married in July 1934. And it was a rainy day. And I'd bought a green coupe, and you know what? Confetti would look. And we had the services in the shul. No, had the services in Rosalind's home. And then we had the reception at the hotel.
Now she was a...
Cohen. Rosalind Cohen.
She was Cohen and...
C-O-H-E-N. Lovely Cal mother Copen's and father. There's a picture of them there. They were... I was just like a son to them. In fact, I was better than some of their sons at some times.
Carl and Herbert Coben are their sons.
Yes, Carl and Herb, yeah. Late changed their name. Anyway, so we were married, and I had told Rosalind, you lied to me the first night we were married. You said you were an easy sleeper. And we stopped at the hotel, the Hershey Hotel. It was beautiful in those days. And we had a corner room. And the wind there would blow the Venetian blind way up and bam, way up. And Rosalind slept right through it. She said she was an easy sleeper, you know. Anyway, she was a remarkable lady. So we had a son born in December of 35. And he was named David Neeson. Neeson after my grandfather. He was the most distinguished gentleman I ever knew. He just loved children. Neeson. Very frum, you know, fill him every morning, you know, and everything. Remarkable gentleman. And David must have been named after Rosalind's grandfather on his mother's side, Finkelstein, I think. In fact, that painting there is by her aunt, which she painted, Clara Finkelstein, yeah. So we had a son, and we did the usual thing in summer to the shore, either Rehoboth or what, you know, the usual thing. And then he went to grammar school here. And he wasn't doing so good. I don't know why, because his mother, you know, at home he was learning. And I handled his math and his brother handled his English. And we had him examined by organizations. And he was bright, but in school he just, nothing. In fact, one course in agriculture, he flunked. He said, Pop, what do I know about, farm machinery anyway? So they organized the St. Andrew's School here, Episcopal School, which, by the way, I was at his 50th ordination at St. Augustine Church last Sunday. Dr. Pell was 50 years since he was made a priest. They were nice enough to ask him. So took him out of school here. And Pell was in the office with a dog when he was about 3-4 years old. He said, you have to send David to St. Andrews. But he forgot to tell me that you got to take an examination to get in. Anyway, we decided he wasn't doing anything here. The school wasn't accredited, and when I was mayor, I had to fight to get it accredited because half of the youngsters lived here, and I felt responsible. Now, the average mayor would go to graduation and give them a little $10 gift to call it the mayor's prize and get applauded. And here I have, it made me sick that our school wasn't accredited. Well, I found out who credit the schools, and up in Philadelphia, Wharton School. And I got hold of it. And I so shamed them that, you know, I got it accredited. The principal here said, I don't have time to fill out the forms. I said, you correspond with 50 nations in Esperanto. So finally, we got an accredited.
Did you? You didn't send your son there?
Yes.
Oh, you did.
He went there till the eighth grade.
To St. Andrews?
No.
No, to the grammar school.
Sure, that's right.
And then did he go to St. Andrews?
That's right. St. Andrews was a five-year high school. So we entered him. Of course, he had to take an examination. So we tutored him in summer and had a Latin teacher tutor him. And he got in all right. But the first month or so, he'd say, Pop, I don't belong out here. I haven't had the background. So I went out to see Pell, and I said, why don't you put him in the pack a year? You know, it's a five-year. He said, no, we examined him. He'll be able to do it. I said, okay. And over there, to get in, you have to give them a financial statement. You pay, you know. So I think I was paying $1,200 a year, and the highest was $1,600 per million. So now, every Sunday, chiefly his mother, his mother wasn't able to go, I went. We would take him out of St. Andrews and take him up to Temple School.
In Wilmington.
Sure, Wilmington.
Temple Beth Shalom.
Sure, that's right. And we joined the Temple after they were married, naturally. So I've been a member there for 45 years. Yeah. So, now, this is odd. He was number one in sacred studies at St. Andrew. See, it's a church school. And so when he would write theses on religion at Harvard, he said, Pop, I'd sometimes have to look up the Old Testament, not the New Testament. I knew that by heart.
Yeah.
So, at the end of the year, at the end of his first year at St. Andrews, he was in the honor group, and they kind of kidded me about it. So then, he was number one every year in his class, except the last year, he tied with a fella. So there they give you a certain honor. So he won the Founders Medal, gold medal, which is the highest award. There. 20 years later, he was called back and named an illustrious alumnus and given the Headmaster's Medal. Every few years, if they find out someone who's making out exceptionally well that they're proud of, they...
What does he do now?
Well,
Where is he?
He's in St. Louis, but he has several firms. I'll go into it later on.
Did he, as a youngster, experience any anti-Semitism here in Middletown?
Yes, yes. See, he wasn't brought up that way, but he said some of the big boys, you know, only, and so even at St. Andrews, he didn't realize it was anti-Semitism. He wasn't brought up that way. So when the headmaster, Pell, found it out, he called those boys in. And that stopped that. You know what I mean? He was going to throw them out of school. And so Pell and I have been very close friends. So then when he graduated number one here, he didn't know what he wanted to be. Whether he wanted to be a rabbi, whether he wanted a business, whether he wanted to be a lawyer. But this is
also odd. He had ponies and what, dogs when he was growing up, but he just lacked that knack with animals. He took more after his mother's side. So he would ride with me, and farmers would say, "Dave, what are you going to be?" He said, "Pop, I didn't want to hurt your feelings." I asked to say, "I guess I'll be a veterinarian like my father." But he said, "Pop, you know, I'd never make a good veterinarian." I'd say, "Dave, I don't want to hurt your feelings. But usually I can write a letter to the vet school for any boy by things competent, and he gets in." One that's made out very well is Dr. Philip Hector. I got him and with only a letter. And I were close friends. So I said, "Dave, I don't want to hurt your feelings. I wouldn't write you a letter of recommendation to the vet school." So, you know, he felt good about it. But it was always worrying him. It was worrying.
Did you have anti-Semitism? Did you feel any anti-Semitism in Middletown? Either as a veterinarian or as a just a resident?
Well, there were certain few that were anti-Semitic. Some tried not to show it, you know. So Dave got into, he went to all the colleges, Swarthmore, Penn, Yale, Princeton. And they all, you know, admitted him. So when he reached Harvard, he said, "This is where I want to go." So he laid out fine, and I think he graduated magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard. And they're all smart there. Then he didn't know what he wanted to do. And you know, usually, if a youngster waits around, he loses a year. So finally, I said, "Why don't you take up law as a general business education? Just general." And he had served his 6 months with Chancellor Zeitz, you know, who's now a federal judge. And Zeitz said, "Delaware's not going to hold Dave." He said, "He made me change a decision, and I hope he's right." Well, Dave was excellent on the debating stage. He would debate with Ted Kennedy, you know, who made the president, which is
Were they in the same class?
Yes.
Harvard?
Which is a little story. He was supposed to debate with Kennedy, you know, and the professor said, "Dave, you're going to debate with Kennedy. You have to get a new suit." See, he had hand-me-downs, you know. So instead of writing us, he wrote his grandmother, Lena, and his grandma sent him $300 to buy a
new suit,
tuxedo, you know.
Is this the President Kennedy who died, John Kennedy?
No, Teddy Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy.
Yeah, who's now senator.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, senator. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, Senator Kennedy.
So, and he knows him real well. In fact, when David, he's on an international committee of the B'nai B'rith to save Jews from certain nations, airplanes and stuff. Out of the 1,000 delegates, they selected 5 to go to the White House. Naturally, Dave was one of the 5.
Right. You know. So he's a lawyer.
Yeah, he's a lawyer. But never took a law bar examination.
He uses his law education.
He was going to take one in Washington. And he got sick and he called me up. I said, "Well, you go over to the hospital so that if it's needed, something had happened to him." And I went over and got him. And the bar exam was the next day. And he said, "Pop, you know, I'm never going to practice law. I'm not going to sit in somebody's office and hunt up stuff for them to go before. So at Harvard Law School, he was president of the Harvard Law Forum. He played in the band. All things. He represented Harvard and other schools. Anyway, so at this Harvard Law Forum, they invited speakers, and they ranged from Castro, Mrs. Roosevelt, you know, and governors and kings and, excuse me. While he was president of Harvard Law Forum, he met all these kings and other things. He was the first one who told me that Castro was a bum. So he entertained him over a weekend, had him at the Hilton. He brought 40 bums with him, ran a bill up of something like $16,000. So when he came out of, his last year in Harvard, he got married. Now, knowing that he was not going to practice law, I had him entered in Harvard Business School. And then he didn't know it. I was going to have him take a year at MIT in engineering, which he was very good in engineering. So while he was at Harvard Business School, a firm by the name of Lusk Corporation, who all of their executives came from Harvard Business School, offered him a job in the construction field for $33,000 a year, you know, and he just got married. So that brought him into the construction business. And in 4 years, he was